Welcome to the first episode of Ask an Ex-Mormon Therapist. I'm your host, Jenny Morrow, and I am so excited to be doing this show. So this is the first episode. I hope to have guests come on and join me and help me go through some of these questions and letters in some of the episodes, but today it will just be me. So I am really excited to be sharing some of the things I've been learning in the last couple years working with ex-Mormon issues and religious transition issues in my therapy practice. And I just really wanted a way to share all of the information that I was gathering with more people, and this was one of the ideas I had. So I hope it'll be helpful. You can send in any letters or questions to exmormontherapist@gmail.com, and I go through the letters each week and pick a letter or two to share and then go through and discuss it. So the idea here is just to give a forum where people can ask someone who's done a lot of therapy questions. So I'm not acting as a therapist on this show. I'm not sitting here with any of the people who have written these letters. I can't ask for clarification if I have questions. So this is just one person, just me giving some thoughts and ideas. I've been a therapist for about 8 years and sat in over 7,000, 8,000 sessions. I have really started to gather information about the patterns of what works and what doesn't work. And sometimes I have some ideas that can be helpful, sometimes I don't. Some of the things I suggest or say might feel good for you. They might kind of resonate as something that would work. Other things might be triggering or feel icky, or you might think, I've already tried that, it didn't work. So, you know, whatever experience you have as you're listening, just take that as information. And hopefully with your own responses to my ideas and thoughts in the discussion, maybe if nothing else, that will give you some ideas of where you want to go. So one thing I found as I've worked with my own process of religious transition and as I've worked with clients is that it really is possible to use the frustration, the pain, all of the difficulty of the experience and do something positive and productive with it. We can't make the experience go away. We can't deny that it happened. Well, we can try to deny that it happened, but it will show up in some way. The triggers will come, meaning the emotional surges of sadness or frustration or numbness or apathy or depression or whatever, they will come, and there will be moments where they come, whether it's about religious transition or whether it's about anything else in your life. So the idea is learning how to take those surges of emotion, learning how to take literally that energy that's rising in you and to turn it into something that helps you reach the kind of life you want to live, not only outwardly by actually accomplishing certain goals or accomplishments, but inwardly so that you can actually have the kind of inner feelings and experience that feel meaningful to you individually as a person. And my main goal in starting this podcast was just simply to help people. I feel super, super grateful for the people who've helped me through the process. And so I find that it has gotten to where I look back and I feel a sense of happiness and nostalgia and appreciation for having been able to work through something that's been so difficult. Again, not only with religious transition, but also with some other struggles or what felt like challenges to me in my life. And so it really feels exciting and rewarding to be able to pay that forward and watch other people go through the experience of finding change, progression, evolution, healing, you know, whatever you want to call it, rather than just staying stuck forever. I know what it feels like to feel stuck, and it's an icky feeling, and I know what it feels like to feel like I can't get out of my anger, or I can't get out of my sadness, or I can't get out of my obsession with whatever my coping mechanism is at that time. And so as we look to find a sense of fulfillment, a sense of meaning, a sense of joy and aliveness in our life, I hope that this podcast can be one thing that might offer some fun ideas or some helpful ideas. So all that being said, I'm going to start with one letter today. And this was a fairly detailed letter. It wasn't like incredibly long, but it wasn't short. It was kind of medium. But it felt like there were enough questions involved in the letter that we're going to focus on just the one letter today. And what I'll do first is I'm going to read through the entire letter. Then I'll come back and kind of pick apart and discuss certain sections. So this letter came through from Joe Exmo. And Joe Exmo said, "Dear ex-Mormon therapist, after I learned the truth about the church, my whole world shattered and I found everything meaningless. I am still stuck in this trap. I visited other therapists and they just call it an existential crisis. They said that it would pass and that I just needed to create my own meaning. More on that later. All of this caused so much stress in my life that I became deeply and clinically depressed. My doctors prescribed a variety of antidepressant medications, and none of them worked and actually made my depression worse. I found a psychiatrist who prescribed a different medication, and that has helped me be more stable, but I am still suicidal every day. Don't worry, I won't kill myself. I'm just sharing the facts. My psychiatrist explained that extreme stress can often bring on mental health issues on a biological and physiological level, and not just on an emotional level. If all of this is biological, I feel damaged, as if I can never recover, much like someone who breaks their leg still has a limp. Well, that is the background and context you requested. I would really like to talk about meaning. I find the universe totally empty and meaningless. I find life painful. Because it is painful, I do not find it worth living. Why should I tolerate pain? Yes, I love my family and they are great. Yes, I enjoy skiing and good restaurants and good concerts, but given the pain of life, these things do not compensate. These things still don't make it worth it. I hate myself for saying that. I hate myself that my family is not enough to make me happy. I do love them, but I find it so exhausting to bicker with my wife or to deal with my bratty teenagers. My wife and my kids are great, don't get me wrong. But everything is such a pain and is so exhausting. I don't know how to create my own meaning. I've read countless self-help books and philosophy texts and visited therapists for months. And I listen to everything I can find on YouTube about happiness and energy and Tony Robbins and all that jazz. I also find that when I try to create meaning, I am just deceiving myself. My purpose is to help those in need. My purpose is to compose beautiful music for others to listen to. At the end of the day, I still have to suffer through the pain of everything: work, bills, stress, pressure, sitting in traffic, taxes. It is all so miserable and unbearable now. Some people just seem to have a natural passion or interest in something that fascinates them to such an extent that the pain of life is comparably minuscule. Even Nevermos have this. Some people just love cars, so they start a mechanics shop and they love it. Some people find the human body fascinating, so they become doctors. I've never had any kind of passion like this. I like music and skiing and cooking, but I don't find it realistic to become a professional musician or Olympic skier, and I don't want to start off as a line chef working 12-hour days for low wages just so that in 15 years I might be a respectable chef. Please don't tell me to just, quote, believe in my dreams, close quote, either. I have real obligations to my wife and family. I am not in a position where taking a lot of risks would be wise. I feel very stuck, and this makes me so unhappy. I know I sound like a whiny and weak person in saying all of this. Just so that you know, I have a master's degree, and I work as a consultant in my field, and I charge over $150 an hour. I'm not a failure who just won't work or who finds life stressful in a paycheck to paycheck kind of way. I just can't tolerate all of the miserable stuff anymore because why should I? There's no reason to. I just see pure pain. I have nothing else to hold on to ease the pain or to outweigh the pain and make life at the very least tolerable. Please don't tell me to reinterpret my thoughts or to just not worry about the deep questions that thrust me into depression or to focus on the pleasure instead of the pain. I think questions about meaning matter, and my pain is not a matter of skewed perception. It is real. Some people are fortunate to enjoy the blissful delusion and ignorance of the church. I no longer do, and I am totally lost. I do value truth above delusion, though, so I do not wish to return to that ignorant state. I just don't know what to do. Why is life worth it? Thanks, Joe Exmo." So, Joe Exmo, thank you for sending in this letter and for offering some detail and context to it. There's a lot in here. And as I first read it, I could just feel it in my body, that experience of at least what it's been like for me to feel like there's no meaning. When I first read it, I think I even resonated with the sense that, ooh, it's scary to read about this because the truth is it could happen again, you know? Oh, with any kind of loss, we have certain experiences, and you know, any of us could go through an experience today or tomorrow or next month that leaves us feeling like life is worthless or there's no purpose. And that experience could be health problems, an accident. It could be the death of someone we love. It could be the ending of a relationship, something, you know, the loss of an important job or a valued job. So there's a variety of things that can leave us feeling empty and void and meaningless. One of the things that concerns me as I read the letter is that it's been going on for a long time, it sounds like. And I'd be curious, you know, how long. But whether it's been a month, whether it's been a year, whether it's been 5 years, either way, the fact that it feels like you're stuck and there's not movement, that's a really, really hard place to be. And I just want to say that yes, this is obviously a real experience for you. We'll talk a little bit about some ideas that, you know, my hope is might give you some sense of where to put your attention and energy right now to keep this moving. You mentioned that after you learned the truth about the church, your whole world shattered. So a lot of people have different experiences when they leave the church. For some people, their whole world shatters. For other people, parts of their world shatter. So the fact that your whole world shattered says to me a lot of the things you had done, a lot of the choices you'd made, a lot of your experiences and perspectives were built on the truth claims of the church. That just makes it a little bit more painful. It doesn't mean you did anything wrong. It just means that as you moved through life and did the best you could and trusted what you thought was the best thing to trust, you know, that betrayal was really, really big for you. You know, that for whatever reason, however many conditions were all lined up perfectly to make this an earth-shattering experience to find out the truth, you know, whatever reason it is, that's the reality for you. And so that's where you're working from. You mentioned that you visited other therapists and you said just call it an existential crisis. And yeah, you know, what I hear you saying there is that it's not helpful to have it labeled without knowing how to shift out of it. They said it would pass and you would just need to create your own meaning. Problem is that that's not happening. So again, that's going to be important to acknowledge that whether this is an existential crisis or something else, the label's really not all that important when you aren't finding a way to shift it or change it. The other thing I wanted to acknowledge here in the introduction was when you talked about your psychiatrist explaining this extreme stress can bring on biological and physiological changes, not just emotional symptoms. So, yeah, that is a reality. And you'll know more as you move into the future how much of that is healable, fixable, changeable, how much of it is not, right? So, if you lose a finger, you know, I remember I had a friend in junior high who lost the tip of her finger and she took it into the hospital and they sewed it back on. So she still has the tip of her finger. I know someone else who lost a finger and it was not repairable. And so this person now has no finger. So sometimes we don't know for sure how repairable things are. But again, the question becomes, okay, so if something has happened to me that is going to leave me never fully recovered in the way I once was, what does that mean to me? Because what it sounds like is there's a sense that if there's some continuing, quote, damage or effects from the injury, that something about that is bad or wrong. Like you said, someone who breaks their leg has a limp. So again, we can see that as a bad thing, or we can see it as something that was sucky, but that maybe rather than focusing on running or playing football like this broken person leg once did, maybe now they focus on teaching or they focus on something that allows them to use their mind instead of their leg. So, it's amazing how adaptable we can be when we open up to possibility. But is it true that we may never be the same as we were before a certain experience, earth-shattering experience happened? Yes. It also reminds me a little bit of the Hunger Games book. So, spoiler alert, if you want to not hear this, go ahead and fast forward. I remember I read all three Hunger Games in a couple of weeks because I wanted to catch up for a book club. And so I got to the end of the third book, and at the end of the third book, Katniss and her husband live kind of out in the country in a home that's sort of created for a sense of peace and calmness. She has a couple of children, and some days she still talks to her children about how she has nightmares. So I remember reading the end of the book and really liking it because I thought that is true. Sometimes we've been through so much that we can't live the same kind of lifestyle that we once did before. And again, this can look like a lot of different things. So, when I went to book club that evening, I was surprised to find 99% of the other people in the book club were saying, "Oh, I hated how the book ended. She was so strong. She was so strong through all these wars or games. And then at the end, she just broke. And she just couldn't maintain it anymore." And I thought, ah, but that's so true. That's so true of our real lives. Sometimes we're in survival mode and our system just keeps going and going and going until finally it breaks and it's over. Meaning, even though we may still, quote, survive, we may have to live and express life in a whole different way than we once did. And that doesn't mean that having a limp is bad, and it doesn't mean that having scars is bad, and it doesn't mean that even some residual pain is bad. It just means that it's a different kind of life, and where we put our attention and our focus and energy might need to be different than where we put it before. So, as I say all of that, I'm not saying it to fix what you're going through because I have a feeling you've been doing a lot of that, a lot of trying to fix this experience. And it might be a part of what's creating some of the friction for you right now. So I want to talk a little bit more about that. In my therapy practice, I work with a four-step process, and it's a process that I've put together based on different things that I've studied and read and watching client patterns, and then practicing everything I teach myself. And I've kind of put together a process that I've found works for me. And it works when I teach it to my clients and they apply it. So it's the process that I work with the most. But in this process, one of the steps is taking action. But that's the fourth step. That's the very, very last step in this process. There's three steps before that are actually really important. So if you're trying to fix this experience of I have no meaning, if you're trying to take action and fix it and it's not working, that's good information that you're prematurely taking action and you need to back way up. If we take action and the action works, great. But if it doesn't, or people are saying, well, try this or try that, and we try everything and we're taking all the advice and we're doing, 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 and it's not working to fix the pain inside or the emptiness inside, then that is a good information that we need to just back way up into the beginning of the process. So I'm going to go through some of the process today on this call. And I'll go through it again in the future. And so hopefully it will give you a chance to really start practicing applying this, whether you're Joe Exmo that's listening or whether you're anyone out there that's listening. And this can be applied to, the feeling of meaninglessness that can come up with leaving religion, but it can also be applied to that feeling of emptiness and loss and meaninglessness when you, lose a relationship or a job. So hopefully it will be helpful and applicable in different areas. The acronym I use for this four-step process is POET, POET, and I use the acronym as just a way to remind myself that we get to create the poetry of our own lives. And I don't even know what that means, other than, gosh, is there meaning or not meaning in this world? I don't know. I don't know. I have different inclinations on different days as to whether there's meaning or not. But either way, one thing I've experienced over and over is that we can take the ingredients of the moment, we can take what we have in the moment, and we can create something with it. Let's start at the first step. So the acronym POET, and the first step is presence. It's becoming present with the moment. So it tends to happen when we're feeling something we don't want to feel or experience, we try to resist it. We either try to run away from it and not feel it, or we try to fix it. Because if we can just fix it, then the bad feelings will go away. But if the fixing it's not working and the running away is not working, then eventually all we have to come back to is to be present with it. It's to sit with the experience and start to really become acquainted with it. So I often think of it like sitting with our own children or sitting with, you know, a beloved or sitting with something we genuinely care about, because this is a part of you. It's a part of your experience. And so to deny it or push it away or try to fix it before it's ready to be fixed often is what causes us angst and pain and frustration. I should say more angst and pain and frustration. So Joe Exmo, one of my suggestions would be to actually back up and just practice sitting with what it feels like to experience a painful life and a meaningless life. And if that doesn't feel safe, you know, find a therapist that you can maybe have their support as you do this, because it can feel a little scary for us. A lot of us aren't used to sitting in discomfort. Again, we've spent a lot of our life running from discomfort instead of sitting with it. Or it's just come up and swallowed us whole. But again, I find that when discomfort takes over, it's because we're scared to be with it. Okay? So this is a different experience than just letting depression sweep you away or letting meaninglessness sweep you away into those suicidal places. This is letting ourselves start to step back and observe the experience of what it's like. So I use a few things when I'm practicing becoming present. First, I start with the moment. So whoever's listening to this, you know, you're responding in your mind to whatever I'm saying. You're having your own thoughts and responses. But what I want you to do for just a minute is I want you to just start to notice the moment. So the breath is a good thing to use because it's always there with you. So you can just start by noticing your inhales and exhales. Just notice how the breath moves in and out. I mean, you didn't even notice it was moving probably until I brought it up. We're so used to the breath just taking care of itself. And then start to notice the sounds of the room. Maybe reach out and touch the texture of something nearby. Notice how it feels on the hand, if it's warm or cool, soft, rough. So really coming into the moment. For some people, this can feel really uncomfortable. For some people, it feels relaxing and relieving. For some people, it's neutral. But as you come into the experience, just noticing, how am I feeling right now? And if when you come into that space, you feel this, ooh, this void, this pain that's just all-consuming, or at least it feels like it's going to be all-consuming if you feel it, you know, start to notice where you're feeling that pain in the body, where you're feeling that emptiness in the body. It might be in the heart and chest. You might feel tightness in your belly. You might feel heaviness in your back. You might feel heat rise in your face. Or it might feel open, soft, loose. So again, I don't know what the experience is as you get into this moment and really check in with, how am I really feeling right now? But in those moments when the sense of emptiness and meaningless and pain comes in, the first practice is to get into the moment with it. So start to notice the breath, sounds of the room, and then check in. You know, how am I doing right now? Whoop, yep, it's big. How high is it? The pain on a scale of 0 to 10? It's an 8. How is it manifesting in my body? Tightness, heat, coolness, heaviness. What kinds of thoughts and stories is it bringing? I usually don't have people sit with the mind too much initially, because even though it's a really important part of the process, a lot of us are so used to following the stories of our mind and we get lost in them. So to sit with our mind and be present is really tricky, because we just start to whoop, get looped into it and believe the stories. That's why it's often most helpful to start with the body and the breath when we're practicing this first step of the process. So that's a little bit about the P in POET in this four-step process. The second step is owning reality with compassion. That's what the O stands for, owning reality with compassion. So again, what we want to do is we want to resist it, push it away, run away, fix it. And if we can't do that, then we hate ourselves, we hate the world, we hate any kind of divine anything that we've believed in. I mean, whatever, we hate whoever or whatever's creating this experience, whether it's us, someone else. So owning reality with compassion is actually one of the trickiest steps for us when we're experiencing something we really, really would give anything not to experience, to the point that we actually want to take our life sometimes, right? So the feelings of suicide, the feeling of wanting to die is a really good indicator that A, some part of us wants to shift and change and symbolically die, because we don't want to feel what we're feeling anymore. It's that awful. And if we can't figure out how to have that part of us die and a new part be rebirthed, you know, symbolically or metaphorically, then we actually feel like we want to take our life. You know, that's a real feeling. So being able to sit with that and start to own this reality with compassion. Okay, one of the reasons people get really, really scared, myself included, to own reality with compassion is I feel that if I own it, it will never change. So if I sit with what I'm feeling right now and I sit with it in compassion, it's never going to change. And that's just a story that our minds created. We've built up so many walls and defenses to not experiencing what we're afraid of. And my sense, Joe Exmo, is that the reason your whole world shattered was because Mormonism was actually a coping mechanism on some level for you. You used it to keep you from facing probably some really deep fears and some deep questions. And that's what religion ends up being for a lot of us. And obviously not consciously, but we were maybe modeled that. We were modeled to use religion as a way to avoid facing certain fears and questions. And so we just perpetuate that coping mechanism. You know, much like a family might perpetuate anger as a coping mechanism or alcoholism as a coping mechanism. Now, religion also has, you know, we might have found some benefits from it, and there might have been some helpful parts. But what you'll find is when you leave religion, you should be able to kind of renegotiate those. If it feels shattering, then that again is good information that it was one way of trying to cope with something that feels deeply, deeply scary to look at. So owning reality with compassion, a few ideas for how to do that. You said your family is great, you enjoy skiing, good restaurants, and good concerts, but those things don't seem to compensate for the pain of life. They don't seem to make it worth it. And then you said, I hate myself for saying that. I hate myself that my family is not enough to make me happy. And so there was a sort of turning that anger inward towards yourself. So again, as you sit with this feeling of what it feels like to experience empty and meaninglessness, what it feels like to experience life as ultimately painful, that you start to turn that anger and that shame inward towards yourself. So a couple of ideas. You can acknowledge, no wonder I'm beating myself up for this, because I want to feel better. And the fact that I'm not satisfied with what's there is so distressful that I think something's wrong with me. Rather than sitting with it and saying, the reality is, in this moment, nothing feels worth it to me. And what is it like to feel that? Oh, I feel tightness in my stomach. I feel heaviness in my heart. I'm believing the story that life will never be worth it. And believing the story that this pain can never get better. And to let yourself really notice and be with yourself as you're in that experience. Even as therapists, we sometimes jump in and try to fix too soon. And this is when we bump up against clients' resistance. And this is one of the things I think you're probably experiencing, is that you might even be getting a reflection of shame from other people, like other therapists or physicians, who think you should be able to be feeling better, but you're not. Okay, and again, if that's happening, all we can do is step back into that space and say, I don't know why I'm not better. I don't know why people seem to be moving on, but I'm not. The only way to shift and change ultimately isn't to beat myself up, because that just makes it worse, right? But it's to sit in compassion. And if we are beating ourselves up, sit with that in compassion. Oh, this is me beating myself up. This is me believing that something's fundamentally wrong with me because I can't be satisfied with life. Okay, that's called, in therapy, we call that shame. Believing that something's wrong with us and that's why we're experiencing suckiness in our life. That's why we're experiencing pain. Okay, so here's a few phrases to practice with. Once you practice presence, that first P, that first step, and you notice something you don't like, or you're noticing the pain, you're noticing the meaninglessness, some phrases for working on owning reality with compassion. One phrase is, no wonder I feel this. No wonder life feels meaningless. No wonder my relationships with my family aren't enough. So you might have some ideas as to the no wonder, and you may not. If you don't have any ideas, then this phrase won't be super helpful. But if you do, for example, no wonder my relationships with my family aren't enough. A, maybe I haven't developed the kinds of relationships I want with them yet, so they don't feel all that fulfilling. Or B, maybe there are some other underlying pains that need to be addressed, and so no matter how good my relationship with my family is, I'm going to feel this nagging void because I'm not sure how to face or look at something like my work situation or my career situation or, you know, these existential questions. I don't know how to face those. So if there's a void outside of the relationships, then that may also be what's calling to you. Or maybe the relationships themselves are not very satisfying and that some work needs to be done there. So, you know, there's a variety of reasons that these things, good restaurants, good concerts, your relationships with your family, there's a reason that that's not enough, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's just you may not know the reason it's not enough yet. And we'll get to exploring that more, but first, it's just you've got to be with it. Because we can't move into the third step, which is exploration, until we've really, really gotten into it and sat with it enough that we can soften and more information can come in. As long as we're trying to resist it, run away, or fix it prematurely, then we've automatically judged our experience as bad, and we've shut down the openness that can allow our subconscious to bring us more information into the conscious awareness. So this is actually really fascinating how all this conscious and subconscious stuff works, because, you know, as I've practiced these things, life has gotten better. It does. It doesn't mean that we don't feel pain, and doesn't mean we don't feel deep, deep grief sometimes rise, but that we start to be less afraid of it because we know we can sit with it in a way that will actually shift it and change it. But step two is probably the most skipped over step, and as long as we skip over it, we will get stuck on exploration and we will get stuck in taking action. It's like our efforts will not pay off. They won't pay off. So owning that reality with compassion, releasing the shame, and acknowledging there's nothing wrong with me for being here. And there could be 100 therapists that tell me it's just an existential crisis and here's what you do. But if that doesn't work for me, it doesn't work for me. And that's information. We may translate that information to mean we'll never find meaning, okay? And that's not what I'm sensing the information is about, but I'm sensing that it's telling you that your efforts are not, it's not where the energy needs to be applied right now. It's that the efforts are not effective because something else is needed, and you're just not quite clear about what that is yet. And nor is anyone who's been helping you. Okay, another phrase for owning reality with compassion. So one of the first phrases is no wonder. No wonder I'm feeling this. No wonder I'm experiencing this. No wonder I'm thinking this. The next phrase that can be helpful is even though I'm dot, 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 I honor and love myself. And I will literally just take these phrases and I'll take one and I might practice it for a whole week. So, you know, one step, Joe Exmo, might be to practice this one phrase for a week. And whenever life feels meaningless and whenever you're feeling that pain rise, and maybe it's always there under the surface, but whenever you feel kind of the surge, that wave come of the, ugh, that when that comes, that you can step back and you can say, even though I'm feeling this right now, I honor and accept myself. Because what we want to start doing is shifting away from I hate myself. Because we just shut our subconscious down when we do that. It's like a little child and it goes, fine, you hate me, I'm backing up then. I'm going to hide again. So to even start to get more information from this part of us that actually might know more than we realize we know, to get it to open up and to communicate with our conscious awareness, we've got to soften around it and we got to love it. I don't know, it's like a little kid, it just works that way. So even though I feel like life is meaningless, even though I don't know how to get out of this, I honor and accept myself, or I honor and accept my own process of learning, or I love and accept myself. And I give these different options because some of them might work for you, some might not. I've had clients say to me, but I can't love myself in this. And I'll just say, okay, then that's good information. You're gonna have to start back even a little bit further. And you may say, even though I don't know how to be compassionate to myself in this, I honor and accept myself. So you can back it up as far as you need to go until you can, on some level, believe that there is some care, acceptance, and trust you have for yourself, in yourself. And I've yet to work with someone who hasn't been able to back it up enough that they can find that spot of resonance where they can kind of laugh about it, like, okay, that's where I can have some acceptance for myself. So first phrase that you could work with is no wonder. No wonder I'm feeling this, thinking this, experiencing this meaninglessness. The other phrase is, even though I'm feeling this, even though I'm still stuck, I honor and accept myself. And the other phrase is just to give it even more space. And the phrase I use for that is, this is what it feels like to believe that life is meaningless. This is what it feels like to believe that life is more painful than it is beautiful. You know, this is what it's like to believe I'm never going to get unstuck. This is what it's like to feel stuck. So I use the phrase, this is what it's like, dot, dot, dot. Because again, it's a way to get into the experience, and rather than trying to fix it or push it away or run from it or let it sweep us into its story, we can start to acknowledge that this is what it feels like to believe I'm never going to get unstuck. It's an awful feeling. That story may not be true, but this is what that feels like. I feel heat in my heart. I feel rage in my body. And you breathe with it. You start to notice it. You give it space. You love it. You give it compassion. It doesn't mean you respond to its story or buy into it. We don't have to take that anger and go out and punch someone in the face with it. That's not, you know, that's running away from the anger. That's not working with it in a way that's going to help you get realigned with yourself. So the first step is to just stay with it. Own reality with compassion. The truth is, right now, Joe Exmo, you feel stuck. And no matter what I say or what anyone else says, or no matter how much your conscious mind tries to force yourself into feeling meaning, the reality is, right now, that's not what you're experiencing. And we have a lot of stories and judgment about that, because a lot of us grew up in a situation where we were taught that having meaning was like above and beyond the most important thing, right? But again, I'm sensing it was actually more of a coping mechanism. That's not to say that having a sense of meaning isn't an important experience and it's not valuable. I mean, that's part of why I'm doing this podcast, right? But I find that ultimately it only works in the long term if the meaning that we're creating in the moment is actually bringing us a personal sense of fulfillment and enjoyment and aliveness. And this is what's so crazy and interesting about religion, is we may actually experience some joy and aliveness and fulfillment from the moment-to-moment experiences. So for example, I remember sometimes visiting teaching and like having really good, fun experiences. Like, oh, I love sitting and talking with that woman. And it was so fun and enjoyable. You know, oh, no wonder visiting teaching's inspired. Dun, da, da. Right? In that moment, I had a nice experience. It felt fulfilling. It was enjoyable. But then what we sometimes do in religion is the parts that don't feel good, like the weeks I didn't want to visit teach, and I didn't even have the question of whether or not I wanted that or didn't want it going on. I just had the rigid boundary up, right? When we're doing things out of obligation in religion, then that's not about meaning in that moment. The reason we might keep doing it is because we believe that ultimately, on the other side, after death, then we'll get the rapture and the joy and the fulfillment, okay? So meaning is not so much about, you know, like service to the world, like that's a part of it, but ultimately what we want to feel is a sense of aliveness, And I got that word from Joseph Campbell. I used to say what we really want is a sense of intimacy and connection with our own truest, most real self and others' real selves. But I really liked when I read or I listened to The Power of Myth, which was an interview that Bill Moyers did with a man named Joseph Campbell. And Joseph Campbell, he spent about 50 years studying mythology and religions and cultures of the world. And right before he died, Bill Moyers did this interview with him. And Bill Moyers at one point asked, you know, what is it we're all looking for out of life? Is it meaning? And Joseph Campbell said, no, I don't think it's meaning that we're all looking for. I think what we're looking for is an experience of being alive, a rapturous engagement with life so that we can actually feel, and I'm paraphrasing this here, so that we can actually express or be on the outside who we are on the inside. Okay, so it's something about expressing on the physical plane what it is we feel internally. So that's the sense of aliveness, that who we are on the inside gets to be actually expressed outwardly in the world. And that's where we feel aliveness. And that includes meaning, but it only includes meaning if that meaning is authentic to us. Not everyone would do a podcast like this and feel fulfilled by it. And a year from now or 5 years from now, this may not feel fulfilling for me. I can look back and I can see 10 years ago things that gave me a sense of meaning no longer do because I'm in a different place and my expressions of where I am are different. So I think that you are on a journey. And I don't know what's on the other side or if when you'll experience the expression of meaning you want to. My sense is when a desire is really honest, when it's really our desire, not anyone else's desire for us, but when it's really, really ours, one of my senses is that our subconscious will figure it out if we can sort of prime the pump for it. But what I find, at least in my own life, is that if I'm not working towards what matters to me, then I'm just as stuck as if I'm working towards it and it's not coming to fruition. The only difference is I don't have to feel the disappointment over and over. Maybe instead we just go numb and we cope with something else, right? That's what religion was for in the first place. It was to cope so that you didn't have to go through this process and face these things. So you might find another coping mechanism. And my personal opinion is there's nothing wrong with that. There's no shame in that if that's what happens for us. But what will often happen is at some point, something will show it that coping mechanism for what it is. Okay, that it's not our authentic expression. It's not a reflection of us. It was a reflection of what we were told we were supposed to believe about life. So I say all of this knowing I'm still in my own process of these things. And where I'm going to share a little bit about myself here. For me, when I feel that sense that there is no meaning and there is no purpose, I'm most often triggered into that when I have a relationship that doesn't work out. For me, leaving religion was difficult, and it brought about some days I felt like there was no ground underneath me and I maybe just would prefer to die. So I had that experience on some level, but the real feeling of emptiness and meaningless for me, when that's come up and it's been almost big enough that it swallows me whole and it's almost taken me under, that's come up more connected to not being able to get the kind of love and relationship I want to have. So I'm doing a lot of my own work in that area right now, and it's changing things. Things are changing. So where I once got swallowed up, I no longer do. And I think the same can be true for you as well, Joe Exmo, that religion fulfilled some certain emotional needs for you, and I'm not exactly sure what they were, but, you know, great concerts, good restaurants, good relationships with your family, or medium relationships with your family, wife or children, they are not fulfilling the emotional needs that religion was filling for you at that time. If we were to go into the third step of the process poet, right, we went over presence, practicing becoming more present in the moment, owning reality in that moment with compassion. The next step is that's when we start to explore. And this process of exploration is really fun. It's where we look at our logical errors or fallacies, It's where we start to look at evidence, and it's just kind of a fun part of the process. But it also can be a really scary and uncomfortable part of the process. And it can take us some time, okay? Step two can take time too. Owning reality with compassion. Man, there's times I cannot do that. And so I just sit with it. I know. I cannot own this with compassion right now. I want to resist it and run away from it. And so I own that with compassion. I own the fact that I'm sitting on Netflix watching shows over and over. I own that with compassion. But then when we move into exploration, that part can also take a little while. We kind of dig around. Maybe we find some clues here and there, but it can take a little bit of time. Anyways, that to all say, it might be valuable to start to look at, what are the emotional needs that the church was filling for me? What even are different emotional needs? There's a woman who wrote a book called, it's mostly focused on relationships, and it might be called, oh, The Secret Law of Attraction, I believe, which might be kind of a cheesy, new agey title. But don't turn off your podcast yet. And she's also got a free assessment online that you can take. She'll email you your top four emotional needs. As long as you unclick the little box that says, send me your newsletter. As long as you unclick that, you won't get anything from her but the results on your quiz. And it's an interesting quiz because she's got 21 different needs, emotional needs. She's divided up the human needs into 21 emotional needs. This becomes really important because no matter how much logic and evidence we have, if we have an emotional need that's present, we will twist all the logic and all the evidence that we get to deal with that emotional need. So it's really, really important for us to understand our emotional needs because if we don't know they're there or we're resisting them or pretending we don't have that need or in denial of it, then we actually subconsciously seek that need getting filled above all else. And it's why we sometimes can't reach our goals because we don't realize that underneath a certain goal is another emotional need that is feeling in conflict with it. So for example, if you want to lose weight and you have a need to be accepted by other people physically, and so you decide I'm going to go ahead and lose weight, or I have a need for greater health where I just feel better, right? You're trying to lose weight, or you're trying to eat better, exercise more, but you keep bumping up against this resistance for whatever reason. All you know is that another part of you just wants to keep eating sweets or wants to sit around and not get up and exercise. Well, that's good information that you have another emotional need going on and you're not paying attention to it. It's not getting enough attention, and so it's just going to continue to sabotage you and get itself met, even if it's getting met through, quote, junk outlets. So it's important to know our emotional needs so that we can start to sort all of this out. And yes, we'll get our emotional needs as we sit with the feelings and start to explore them. But this quiz can be a helpful Kickstarter. So if you want to take it, go to www.emotionalindex.com and take the questionnaire. It'll send you your top four needs. If you don't have the book, like I did at the time, then you may look at them and think, well, I don't know what that even means. My top need that came through when I took the quiz was safety. And I remember I said to my good friend, safety, like I feel safe. Like that's not really a need that I'm trying to get met. Because the idea is that our top four needs that show up, the reason that they're so high is because they're not getting met. We're going to start to feel cravings. Okay, so these needs that aren't getting met are going to start to become really high priorities on the list. And they're going to start to kind of give off these signals of cravings. I thought, I don't really need safety. I feel safe. And my friend kind of looked at me confused and laughed. And she said, of course, that's one of your highest needs. So in the last couple years, as I explore the moments when I feel totally out of control, it's often connected to safety. So it gives us some ideas of how to get these needs met in a more effective way. But, we don't even know they're there sometimes. So we might be doing all the outward stuff we need to do, like, going running and having friends and dinner parties, but inside we feel like an empty shell. And that's good information that one of your emotional needs is outside of your awareness, and so it's not getting attended to. Okay. There's a lot here, and I just want to say thanks, Joe Exmo, for being willing to share so much. The other thing that I would The other thing that I would say to you that came up as I was reading this letter is trust yourself. Trust yourself. What you're feeling is real for you. And the fact that you are stuck does not make you bad. It doesn't make you unintelligent. It doesn't mean that you're not putting forward effort. It just means that for some reason, the information that's going to work for you has not shown up yet. And your subconscious might have some of it. I don't know. My guess is it probably does. Your subconscious probably has some of this information, but it hasn't come through into your conscious awareness in a way that you can apply it yet. And there are some different things that might work for that, but I think the first thing to do that is going to help the subconscious loosen up and maybe start to share more with your conscious mind is going to be sitting with all this stuff without so much judgment. As much as you don't like the feeling of feeling empty and having no meaning, it's just a feeling. And we take it as truth or not truth, right? Well, does life have meaning or not? Well, I don't know. What does it feel like for you right now? Because that's the only thing that really matters. If you're experiencing life as meaningless and you don't know how to fix that, then that doesn't mean life doesn't have meaning for you. It doesn't mean you won't experience a feeling of meaningfulness in the future, but it means that right now, in this moment, this is real for me. And if you can hold that and sit with that reality of the moment without getting looped into the story that it means that that's forever, or that it means that you're always going to feel meaninglessness, or that it's never going to change, then it might soften your subconscious up a little bit more. But again, I'm sensing that you're going to need a lot of compassion and self-compassion here because there's been so much push. There's been so much push that you should be somewhere different. And it even comes out a little bit in the letter. And I don't mean this in a bad way, but you're saying, don't tell me this, don't tell me this, which says to me, not only have you maybe felt internal shame, but you've maybe even experienced that from the outside, whether it was real or perceived. You've experienced people trying to get you out of the emptiness, out of the meaninglessness, in some way believing that that's not okay to feel that. And it isn't easy. As a therapist, it's not easy to watch someone struggle for, an extended period of time and feel stuck. But I notice that when I have clients who are in that situation and who come to me and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, why are you still stuck? When I feel that overwhelm about it, that's information about me. Because there's nothing wrong with being stuck, whether it's for a week or whether it's for a year, or whether it's for 10 years, there's nothing wrong with it. And again, we might not like the experience, might not feel good, but if we can release our resistance to it and start to soften, that's one of the things that can start to shift it. So trust that you're in it, you're in your process. And that's the best any of us can do. And in my experience, is it changeable? Probably. Possibilities and probabilities can shift based on conditions, and all we can do is provide the conditions for that possibility. And I think right now you're quote doing everything you know to do. And so maybe stepping back, letting yourself be stuck for a while without having to figure it out. Maybe relaxation is a part of what's needed. Maybe just being able to relax around imperfection right now would be helpful. So I'm just feeling this really strong desire to let you know you're okay. There's nothing wrong with you. And give yourself some space, give yourself some compassion. And if you feel drawn to try things, go for it. Try it. See if it creates a sense of meaning that you're looking for. It may or may not. Again, it may just be another coping mechanism till you're ready to face the next level of this. I don't know, but all we can do is move moment to moment. And when we've hit bottom, when we've hit a place where no matter what we do, it's not working, no matter what we try out here on the outside of us, it's not working. No matter what meds you try, no matter what activities you try, it's not working. That's maybe a signal to go inside and to start sitting with it. Going through this process of poet. And what I would say is start with the first two steps. We didn't go into the third step much today. We'll go into it more in the future. But stay with the first two steps. Practice becoming really present with the moment. And then offer yourself some no wonders, no wonder I'm feeling, thinking, no wonder I'm in this situation in this moment. Or even though I'm feeling or thinking this, I honor and accept myself. Or this is what it's like. This is what it's like to feel no meaning. This is what it's like to feel an overwhelming amount of pain. Doesn't mean the story underneath it's true. Just means that's what it feels like to be in that story. So I hope that's helpful. I hope it's helpful, Joe Exmo. I hope you hear it. And, you know, feel free to email me back and let me know if anything did strike you as helpful. And for all the others out there in listening land, I hope you got some ideas for your own experiences that you're going through. And send any letters or questions you have to exmormontherapist@gmail.com. It's looking like I'm going to try to get an episode out every 2 weeks. So until next time.